So last week, I talked about self-forgiveness. And I talked about how much of our human suffering comes from this undercurrent of feeling something's wrong with me. And how many moments of our day there is some contraction in our heart and in our being because we're having some sense of failure, of not okayness. So that we blame ourselves. And tonight what I'd like to do is, last week what we did is we explored a little bit of how to begin to recognize how pervasive that trance is and how to begin to cut through it and really hold our lives with a genuine kind of kindness. So tonight I'd like to take the other piece of this tendency to blame and judge and armor our heart and explore how we do that with our world. And they go absolutely hand in hand. If we're turned on ourselves, we're divided and we're separated from the world too. We never feel intimate with others when we're down on ourselves. It just doesn't happen. Okay. Does that make sense? I mean, are we all together on that one? That's kind of I just throw that out and assume we're together on that. So in a way, tonight's about stopping the war. And I talk about this a lot. It's one of the topics I try to, in different ways, weave through our year, our time together, because as with so many of you, I'm so pained by the cycles of violence on this earth. And one of the great truths that I think we intuitively know is that we need to act and we need to do whatever we can to bring more peace to this planet. And hand in hand, and basically we have to keep on finding the ways that we can stop the war in our personal lives. It's just not that meaningful if we have these grand ideas for the world, but we're harboring resentment towards our child or partner and creating war there. There's a anonymous saying that goes, who is it that's unhappy? The one that finds fault. Isn't that a great one? These little... And we know it's true. When we're living with judgment, and of course there's different degrees, but when we're having a sense of resentment or judgment or animosity when another is wrong, those are not moments that our hearts are feeling open and benevolent and that we're living fully. We're tight and we're occupied. And if it was at the end of our lives and we're looking back and we're saying, okay, so what mattered? It would be the moments of loving connection, of living fully our hearts. And so a lot of times when I'm working with people, with students or clients, doing pastoral counseling, there's a kind of regret, the sense of moving through life caught in the conditioning to make distances and be at war and blame and so on, a regret for the missed moments. So we'll look tonight at whether it's the kind of way that we habitually hold resentments towards those that we're around all the time, you know, at work or our family, just the little ways that we stop ourselves from really just showing our affection and being playful and being present to those that we don't know. And probably most of us here know what it's like to have really strong opinions about who's causing trouble in the world and really feeling a sense of anger at the ones that we think are violating the peace. I speak for myself. I find myself all the time kind of really angry at certain political figures and how, you know, that might seem benign, like, well, yeah, they are causing trouble. But the truth is that it's not a badness of an individual. And if my heart is angry or hateful towards an individual, then my heart is kind of gripping that hot coal, you know. And you can see even the same kind of judging and making war and kind of contempt between groups that are very similar, religious groups and spiritual groups. It's amazing how you'd think that there's people have so much in common, but almost the competition gets fiercer, and the need to put the other down and put oneself up is, and for some reason, the ego even more needs to distinguish itself. Some of you might remember, this is one of my favorite examples of this, was about a Taoist master who was sitting naked in his mountain cabin meditating, and a group of Confucianists entered the door of his hut, having hiked up the mountain, intending to lecture him on the rules of proper conduct. So when they saw the sage sitting naked before them, they're shocked and they say, "Well, what are you doing sitting in your hut without any pants on?" And the sage replied, "This entire universe is my hut. This little hut is my pants. What are you fellows doing inside my pants?" You know. So these differences in different world views and right and wrong and ethics and religious beliefs. So it's an integral part of waking up for each one of us. Really, if we are genuinely wanting to be free on the spiritual path, to look at our daily life. I'm talking about daily life. This is an idealistic thing. But to look at our daily life and really honestly acknowledge the ways we create distance with others around us. What are the ways that we do that? So we'll look at that a little and then explore how, given this, the habits we have of making others wrong or making ourselves wrong but then removing ourselves from closeness, how, given that, do we begin to soften our hearts? And it takes a lot of courage. And that's the kind of precursors that you can't really honestly soften the armor if you don't have courage. Because that's what we're being asked to do. We're being asked to kind of let go of some of our armoring that we've developed, many of us, for decades when we talk about forgiving. So that we're on the same page in terms of definition, what I call forgiving is letting go of the story of blame and opening to the vulnerability that's here. So we're letting go of the story of you're wrong, I'm right, you're bad. We're letting go of the story and we're opening to what our actual experience is. Now, this doesn't mean that we're giving up wise discrimination. It doesn't mean that we might say to sense our partner is, when you do this or that, our child gets scared or gets ashamed. We're not like throwing aside our capacity to sense cause and effect. And we're not putting down our responsibility to, when we see violence and suffering, to actively do what we can to be helpful. That's not what I mean by forgiving, that we just become a doormat. What I mean is that we're letting go of the story of aversive blame so that we can feel the experience in our own bodies and hearts. Now, before we explore doing that, and of course, as those of you that come regularly know, we will take any of these themes and we'll say, okay, so where is this true for me? And we'll practice right here on the spot, because otherwise it's just ideas. But to begin with, I think it's really important to acknowledge that not forgiving is part of our emotional survival and coping strategy. So to initially not forgive, to initially blame and harden, is actually wired into us. It's not, if we think we're being unspiritual, it's not our fault that when we're wounded, we get angry and feel not forgiving. That is the way our psychobiology is rigged. So when we're endangered, when we're hurting, the brain is designed to scan for causation and do whatever we can to protect further wounding. And as I mentioned, sometimes we scan for causation and moi, I'm the problem, and sometimes it's you, the other. So when it's me, I saw these cartoons with two different t-shirts, and the first t-shirt, it's like this self-blame thing, had a picture of a pregnant woman looking very pained and ashamed, and the words on it were, "I should have danced all night." So that's one t-shirt. And then the second t-shirt, like you went together, kind of another pregnant woman, and she's really angry, and she says, "A man did this to me, Oprah." You know, so it's like blaming outward. So we do one or the other. It's like either I blew it or you blew it. And we're designed to aim the blame and then to help us fix and protect. The difficulty is, especially with very early wounding and vulnerability, that we get addicted to the armoring. It becomes our habit, and that even very little things, and we know this when this is part of our makeup, very little things will resurrect a feeling of being very violated and the need for a whole lot of anger and protection. That's the challenge. It's not an appropriate kind of armoring. It's not like we're bad or wrong. It's just that because we were wounded and it was early, we locked into the habit of a kind of overreaction. So, and we know it. It's kind of a wake up when we realize that our feeling of being mistreated or feeling of being violated or misunderstood keeps re-happening in all these different situations. And we start getting it that it's not like everybody's bad and we're the one that's just the innocent, misunderstood one. It's just somehow or other in every different situation, we're kind of reincarnating the same relationship of being victimized by some bad other. It's kind of a wake up when we start seeing that. Another cartoon I saw recently was of a woman that deep in an African jungle, there's a woman sitting in a hut and she's been sticking pins in a large number of dolls, and the dolls are everyone in her tribe. And her husband comes in and says, "Can't you get along with anyone?" It's kind of same idea. Now, to say again that forgiving, letting go of some of this armoring, it's not like a do-good ethical spiritual thing. Thou shalt forgive. We forgive for the freedom of our own hearts. We forgive because the armoring that's sustained, the habit of always feeling blame or judgment towards others, ends up being injurious to our own bodies and minds and spirits. It's like the pleasure chemicals, the endorphins and the dopamine and the oxytocin, the things that make us feel good, they don't flow when we're blaming. It's that basic. So again, we're not doing it because it's the right thing to do. We're doing it because our sense of the world and the sense of who we are is very contracted and unpleasant when we're caught in the psychobiology of blame. And it's a really hot subject now in a lot of different science experiments, this whole investigation into forgiveness, that forgiving has been linked, as I mentioned, with reduced stress hormones. It's been linked with reduced blood pressure, with experiencing less physical pain, less depression, fewer relapses in substance abuse. So this is good medicine. This is really helpful medicine. But the most basic motivation to play our edge of letting go of blame, letting go of our anger, our hatred, the most basic one, it really is spiritual, which is that when we're in the mindset of "you're bad, you hurt me," the kind of punishing mindset, we are disconnected from the wholeness of our being. We're disconnected from the awareness and the tenderness that really is our home. We're forgetting who we are. And we're forgetting who that other being is. Our reality is contracted into this trance of, it's kind of fixated on the what's wrong, and we're forgetting. So forgiving is really a kind of remembering something bigger. One of the my favorite descriptions of this is the teacher Charlotte Joko back, and I try to share this every time I can, which is that our failure to know joy is directly linked to our inability to forgive. So the bodhisattva path, this path of awakening beings, involves a very intentional, purposeful training in forgiveness. And I can say now that in my life, you know, a lot of times the question comes up, how do you bring these practices of mindfulness, these practices of waking into daily life? And for me, letting judgment be a flag to come into presence and to just let go and open to vulnerability, letting judgment be a flag, has been more powerful in cutting through the conditioning that keeps me in a trance than almost any other practice. Like day by day, any moment that I get caught in the sense of, and there's an undercurrent of victimized, that somebody has offended or mistreated or not cooperated with or whatever it is. If I can pause then and drop the story of being wronged and just open to what's happening right here in this body, this heart, I can rediscover a sense of spaciousness and of who I am. And if I don't, I'm stuck in this small-minded self that's an angry self that's not feeling the dopamine and the endorphins and all that. It's a powerful practice. So the beginning is to start noticing the moments of not forgiving, where in some way our identity has contracted to being the self that's blaming, that's judging. To even just recognize those moments when we're armored in a daily way. I heard on the radio a story of a man and a woman sitting in a living room, and he's saying, you know, if I ever get in a vegetative state dependent on a machine, hon, pull the plug. At which point she gets up and pulls out the TV plug. I thought that was great. So we have all our levels of judgment, and you know what I mean. And it's again, wise discrimination. Oh, if you weren't watching all that TV, maybe you did it. That's okay. But it's the aversiveness, the contempt, the creating, you can feel it in the body, the energetic pushing someone out of our heart in those moments. That's what we're trying to wake up out of. Rilke puts it this way. He says, I live my life in widening circles that reach out across the world. I may never complete the last one, but I give myself to it. These widening circles are our heart, including more and more life, moment by moment in it. There's that teaching from Ramakrishna, which is just not to push anybody, any part of ourselves or any part of anyone else, out of our hearts. So the beginning, as I mentioned, is to become mindful of when we're doing it. There's no way to begin that courageous process of, okay, put down the story, open to what's here, unless we notice it's happening. So I'd like to do our first reflection on this right now and just invite you to kind of check in your life. And I know you've all been in some way kind of checking in already, but let's do it together. It's a wonderful practice to be kind of listening or engaged in some way. And then again, just to pause and check in. So letting this be a pause for arriving. And take a few full breaths. And then just with that sincerity to sense what's true in your life. The inquiry is, so where is their distance? Where is their judgment or blame with another? And for many of us, there can be a number of instances that come to mind, but just let your attention go to whatever most draws you, where you might find yourself very regularly getting contracted in some sense of the other failing or failing you or falling short or betraying you or hurting you. And for now, you might find it helpful not to pick something where if it was a kind of a traumatizing betrayal, that's a little more challenging to pay attention to, but it's up to you. So sensing a situation with someone, and you might even sense the particulars of where what the person does to invoke that reaction of resentment or blame. So that you kind of hone in right to where there's some behavior, some way of being mistreated or ignored or not respected. It feels like that. And you might ask yourself, well, what are you believing in those moments? What are you believing about how the other experiences you? And what happens inside you when you're angry or resentful? How does it feel inside your body? And you can exaggerate it a little to get in touch if it helps you. So just to get a sense of how is it in your body and heart and mind when you're holding against another, when you're tight and angry and hardened, maybe there's a sense of heat, contraction, squeezing, just sense what it's like in your body. Maybe there's words that go with it, what you are in your mind saying to that person. So this is the time just to get in touch with what does it feel like to be angry, resentful, not forgiving. What's your sense of yourself in these moments? How do you like yourself? Now here's another inquiry as we just explore. This is just an investigation. What would you have to feel if you put aside the angry story? If you weren't able to keep on running the anger and the angry story, what would be there that you'd have to feel? To sense in your body what's true here. Put aside the resentful story, the anger of you're wrong, you're bad. What would be there? And you can continue to investigate this. I try to investigate this regularly, and I try to do it here often because it's really important to sense under our stories and our anger, what else is there? So if you'd like to continue to check in, but you can open your eyes if you'd like. And let's just hear from a few people, just say a word or two of what do you notice underneath the angry stories. And speak, if you can, loudly enough so others can hear. Let's hear a little bit of what's in the room. What do you notice? Anyone? What's that? There's compassion. Before you get to the compassion, what do you find?
Fear.
How many found fear? Let's just see hands. Yeah. What else? I didn't hear that. Sadness. So if we go underneath the angry story, there's sadness, there's fear. What else? Maybe we'll raise hands so we can hear one at a time. Yeah. Embarrassment. So there's embarrassment or shame sometimes under there. What else? Yeah. Contraction. You could feel the physical contraction. Yeah. Vulnerability. Yeah, vulnerable. Thank you. Hurt. Hurt. So fear, shame, vulnerable, hurt. Dismissed. So in some way you've been dismissed. And how does it feel to be dismissed? Hurt. Yeah. Anyone else? We don't need a whole lot more, but yeah. I'm sorry?
Betrayal.
That's really big. Betrayal. So I asked you to do this because our experience is layered. And we lock into the blame and the angry stories. But underneath the angry stories, there's vulnerability. It's like the armor is like a scab or a protection for this kind of hurt, vulnerable place. Now, if we continue to stay, and this is the whole teaching, continue to stay not with the story, but the vulnerability, then we begin to discover what Phyllis mentioned, which is the compassion that's here. But we can't get to that. We can't get to compassion or forgiveness unless we open to what the unforgiving armor was covering. Does this make sense? As a process, it's very almost physical that we can't find the tenderness until we open to what's underneath the hard edge of the angry, blaming stories. So then the question comes up, well, what might be wrong with, you know, it sounds pretty good. Okay, put aside the story, open to the vulnerability, find the compassion. What might be wrong, and I'm going to ask you to check this out for yourself, what might be wrong with putting aside the angry, blaming story? What might cause trouble there for you? Check it out. I mean, let's just say, okay, in this situation, I think I'll just put aside this blaming story and just open to this hurt or this sadness or this vulnerability. But what's the problem there? Why don't we all just do that? We'll all agree. We're going to go home and do that, right? So what's the problem? That what doesn't leave? That the problem doesn't go away. In other words, the person can keep doing it and you'll keep getting hurt. So in other words, if I let go of my angry story, I'm just setting it up for it to keep on happening. Yeah. What else? Yeah. Then if you let go of the story, you have to deal with some of those very tangly, difficult, deep feelings of vulnerability. Exactly. There's a reason we'd prefer to stay in our anger than go into where the vulnerability is. What else might be wrong with it? Yeah. Exactly. Right. So with the anger, there's a certain biochemistry with anger that has a temporary pleasantness of it feels powerful, it has a surge, you know, increase the troops, the surge in troops, the surge in the anger, you know that. And not being political, but you know what I mean. It's like for temporarily you feel like, okay, we're going to get it, you know. I am being political. It's true. But yeah, so it feels strong temporarily. The self is puffed. But then it doesn't help, it causes more violence, and yet there's a sense if you let go of it that then there's a wrongness. Okay, I was wrong, I'm weak, and that is a fear. Yeah, thank you. That's really helpful. What else? What else is wrong with letting go of our angry stories? Yeah. It's like a habit, such a basic part of who we are, to dwell on the what's wrong. it would require a whole new way of thinking or being. It's almost like we wouldn't know who we were if we drop that. So much of our sense of ourself and the way we operate is organized around our story of you're bad or I'm bad. Thank you. So there's a lot more we could say, but there's a very strong conditioning to hang on to the blaming. And that's why there's been war on this planet cycles and cycles for centuries and centuries, that it is part of our biology when we're wounded to feel angry and act, that it's very difficult to just stay with the vulnerability, that we have a lot of fear of what would happen if we don't act. So then we come back to, well, what's going to motivate us? And what motivates us to forgive is that as we wake up on the spiritual path, we become more and more aware that what we really long for is obscured if we stay in that trance. That we really can't discover the joy and the love and the realization of our wholeness if we continue to subscribe to those habits of blaming. That's what inspires us. And for many, it's not an all of a sudden thing, like all of a sudden, okay, I'm going to watch the judgments and drop it all at once. But there is a very, and this is, I've worked with so many people on the path now, there's a very clear shift where we get it, that even though it's hard, that our hearts so care about being awake and free that it's worth being with that vulnerability and not continuing to play the storyline over and over again that keeps us small. So the process, as I mentioned, is just what we do when we sit and meditate. The thoughts and the stories come and we go, okay, thinking, not fighting them, but what's happening here? We arrive again in here-ness. And when we're caught in unforgiving, blaming thoughts, same thing. Okay, story of blame, what's here? And then we find what many of you reported, hurt, fear, vulnerability. The process of forgiving is not that we automatically go and say, oh, to this other person, oh, okay, I forgive you. It's really much more inner. A story I like to share because it's so clear-cut was some years ago a woman had listened to a forgiveness talk and kind of come away with this idea of forgiving being a very high spiritual virtue. And then she soon after found that her husband had been having affairs, a number of affairs, and it had been, she was blown away because it really had been something just she absolutely was clueless. And so she came to me and, you know, this, he's a lying bastard. I hate him. How am I ever supposed to forgive him? You know, I'm spiritually doomed, you know, because I can't forgive him. And in a way her friends were supporting her and how, what a jerk he was. So it was like she was caught in the sense of contempt and hatred and non-forgivingness and looking to me to say, well, so here, how do you forgive him? And I said, don't try to forgive him. That's not the first step. The first step is to recognize the stories that are running through and really come home to what's going on inside you. Really come home to it. So we did a lot of work together, and the first layer she came home to was the rage. And I said, okay, rage, just let it be as big as it wants to be. And it was explosive. And when she really gave it room, what she found underneath it was this really profound fear that something was really wrong with her. She was fundamentally flawed that this would happen. And with that, hand in hand with that fear, the shame, like, I'll never be loved, I'm not lovable. So when she got out of the what a lying bastard he was and just kept staying with her own experience, what was there was, I'm unlovable. The fear and shame of I'm unlovable. And she spent months bringing a real presence to that until she was able to, as I've done here many times with the hand on the heart, that kind of real holding of that very deeply wounded place in her that way before this relationship had concluded that she wasn't lovable. And so she had a shift, which was rather than the unlovable self, this fearful, ashamed, unlovable self, she was so present with it that she became this compassionate holder of that place in her heart. And I want to slow down here because this is the shift if we want to wake up our hearts. That we go from being the victim or the bad one to the place of compassion that's holding what's here. After she was able to do that, kind of really sense, I'm this compassionate space of holding, she was able to look at him through eyes that were wise enough to see that this guy was in at that phase of life where he was really fearing that he was worthless and unloved and she was not making him feel special, and it was kind of like he was going to die not be mattering to anyone. So he had all his fears of aging. Not to validate or justify what he did, but just to see his vulnerability and his fear too. So they were parents. They had kids. She divorced him, but not from bitterness and hatred. She divorced him because the trust was broken and she just didn't feel that she could be intimate with him. But she was able to care about him and they could co-parent together without destroying a sense of a field of safety for their kids. I share this with you because, first of all, forgiving and really has to do with self-compassion. When we're not forgiving, it's because we've been wounded. There's some pain in there. There's some fear in there. We don't forgive another until we've opened kindly to the vulnerability inside us. Forgiveness does not mean we don't call our boundaries. You can forgive somebody and absolutely decide never to see them again. You can forgive somebody and decide not to spend time with them, or to protest what they do on the streets, or to write an editorial about. You can do anything you need to do for the sake of healing this planet and healing yourself and healing others. But what causes the trance to be fueled is to continue the stories of angry, aversive blame. That fuels the trance. So it takes training. We might think to ourselves, but, you know, most of the things we're trying to forgive are not like major violations, like a mass murderer or a child abuser. What about those? But the truth is, it's the same thing. Anyone that causes suffering is suffering. Anyone. And that it doesn't, punishing, hating, doesn't help them to heal or doesn't heal anything in our own hearts. There's a beautiful kind of vignette that the source is Africa, the Ku people in Africa, that describe the wisdom around not taking vengeance. Because our judging thoughts are a form of vengeance. In Africa, the Ku believe that the only way to end grief is to save a life. If someone is murdered, a year of mourning ends with a ritual that we call the drowning man's trial. As an all-night party beside a river at dawn, the killer is put in a boat. He's taken out in the water and then dropped, bound so he can't swim into the water. The family of the dead then has to make a choice. They can let him drown, or they can swim out and save him. The Ku believe that if the family lets the killer drown, they'll have justice, but spend the rest of their lives in mourning. But if they save him, if they admit that life isn't always just, that very act can take away their sorrow. Vengeance is a lazy form of grief. Vengeance is a lazy form of grief. Another way of saying that is any of our blaming aversive stories is a way of protecting ourselves from an inner process of grieving or of being with the vulnerability that's here. If we don't forgive, we don't get to heal our own hearts. Let me see what time I have. If I have time to share another story. Yeah. So, another story for you. And this one is, because it's local, this was a man that worked for the State Department, but in D.C., he for many years ran a rehab program for juvenile offenders right downtown. And most of them were gang members that had committed homicide. So one 14-year-old boy in his program had shot and killed an innocent teenager to prove himself to his gang. And at the trial, the victim's mother sat impassively silent until the end when the youth was convicted of killing. After the verdict was announced, she stood up slowly and stared directly at him and stated, "I'm going to kill you." Then the youth was taken away to serve several years in the juvenile facility. After the first half year, the mother of the slain child went to visit his killer. He had been living in the streets before the killing, and she was the only visitor he'd had. For a time, they talked, and when she left, she gave him some money for candy, snacks, that kind of thing. Then she started step by step to visit him more regularly, bringing food and small gifts. Near the end of his three-year sentence, she asked him what he'd be doing when he got out. He was confused and very uncertain, so she offered to set him up with a job at a friend's company. Then she inquired about where he would live, and since he had no family to return to, she offered him temporary use of the spare room in her home. For 8 months, he lived there, ate her food, and worked at the job. Then one evening, she called him into the living room to talk. She sat down opposite him and waited. Then she started. "Do you remember in the courtroom when I said I was going to kill you?" "I sure do," he replied. "Well, I did," she went on. "I did not want the boy who could kill my son for no reason to remain alive on this earth. I wanted him to die. That's why I started to visit you and bring you things. That's why I got you the job and let you live here in my house. That's how I set about changing you. That old boy, he's gone. So now what I want to ask you, since my son is gone and that killer is gone, if you'll stay here. I've got a room and I'd like to adopt you, if you'll let me." And she became the mother of her son's killer, the mother he never had. So that story always really gets to me. And I don't share it in the sense of saying that I could. I don't know what I would do if I had the circumstances of somebody killing my child. It's not a sense of, oh, we should all be able to do this. It's more, there is a capacity in the human heart to, in the greatest griefs, have that strength to stay with the grief and to act in a way that can move us towards healing and not to keep on fueling the cycles of hatred and violence. There is that capacity, and that's the hope for peace on earth. And it's not going to be just that, well, I can forgive the little things, but something bad happens, that's it. It's we have to widen those circles endlessly and endlessly and endlessly. And the place that we begin is right in our daily life, where we have in some way just gotten in the habit of saying, oh, that person, writing someone off, pushing someone away. For the big wounds, the big betrayals, it can be a life process. That's okay. It can take years. It can require therapeutic support, and there's many stages of grief and rage and sorrow and fear. But here's the thing, we can intend to wake up our hearts and to let go of the armor. We can intend it. And if we each leave here tonight with a little more awakeness about intending it, that will ripple out and touch our world. It makes a difference. We're part of the peace movement. Just to intend to soften our hearts when we hit that edge of anger, of blame. In the Buddhist scriptures, it's called the sure heart's release. When we become more and more inclined towards opening, when we reach that kind of hard edge of pain, then shutting down, we begin to free our hearts. In the most basic way, the gift of forgiveness is that we get to discover who we are. To the extent that our life is caught up in this habit of making others better or worse, of living in our stories about who's there, we stay small and we cannot really touch the radiance and the boundlessness and the beauty of this loving presence. That's what we are. We cannot recognize it. So the gift of this kind of dedication to forgive is that we get to find out what we are. We get to realize it and live from it. It's no longer us and them. We really are belonging to our world. So let's close tonight and we'll do a guided forgiveness practice. It won't be long because we've been sitting here for quite a while. But we'll do it and just begin as we always do. Give yourself that sense of connecting again, coming home to your body and your heart right here, just as you are. If there's a way of relaxing or letting go a little in your body, just allowing. Whenever there's tension in the body, that's a sign of not allowing. So just to notice and allow the life that's here to be just as it is. The forgiving practice traditionally begins with asking for forgiveness. And so in this, we begin in a simple way just to recollect a way, a time or a place or situation where we might have caused injury to another person. And each of us has done that in our times of neediness or anger or hurt through our words, through our actions, through our thoughts. So sense where it might be true for you that you've caused hurt to another person. And this is part of being brave in this, to really sense the realness of the hurt, to let yourself feel how it might be for that person. That person's feeling of being dissed or not loved or not seen, not understood. So that you're connected to the experience. We might whisper the person's name mentally and the words in the traditional practice, I see and feel the hurt I've caused you and I ask your forgiveness now. Please forgive me. Please forgive me. So just explore that phrase, I see and feel the pain I've caused you and I ask your forgiveness. Please forgive me. May I be forgiven. Opening, if you can, to the possibility of feeling forgiven. A very sincere kind of presence. The second part of the practice is to sense where we've turned on ourselves, where we've been unforgiving towards our own being, perhaps for ways we've hurt others or ourselves. So just to sense something that might be unforgiven. It might be something today where you felt that you were short-tempered or not really there for someone. Or it might be something historical, a repeating way of being with another person, a way that you hurt yourself, perhaps with addictive behavior. The sense where this is true, and as with the forgiveness of others, we just to let go of the story a little and sense that in you which has driven you to be, to act in ways that are unacceptable. It may be your own feeling of fear or deprivation, confusion. So just to acknowledge the vulnerability in yourself that lies under the unacceptable behavior. And just to offer a kind presence to that vulnerability. In the forgiveness practice, we send the message to ourselves, I see and feel the harm I've caused to myself or others, and I forgive myself now. And I sometimes put my hand on my heart when I do it, just to add a real, sincere, visceral presence. So you might try that. Or you just might simply let the words forgiven, forgiven be offered to whatever in your heart feels unforgiven. So that right now, whatever's going on, whatever you're feeling, if there's any feeling of being divided against yourself, of not okay, forgiven, forgiven. It's the willingness to hold this life, this humanness, with compassion, forgiving ourselves. Forgiven, forgiven. In the final part of our practice together, we bring to mind someone that has hurt us in some way. And again, we've each at times been wounded, felt betrayed, for some abused, for everyone disappointed or let down. So to sense tonight a place where this might be true for you, where someone has caused you injury. It might be the same person you thought of earlier, where there's distance, where your heart has hardened in anger or judgment or blame. And take some moments to sense really the nature of the injury, so that you're being very honest and real that this hurt. You wouldn't be armored with resentment or anger if it didn't hurt in some way. And taking some moments to really bring a full presence to the vulnerability that's here, to the place that feels wounded or afraid. Again, if it helps to just bring your hand to your heart, to offer that added sense of real presence, to breathe with the place that's vulnerable. For some, just the words, I'm sorry, I love you, or I care about this suffering. Just some whispered message of compassion to the place that's hurting. So you can sense the space of compassion, your own awakened heart holding the vulnerability. I care about the suffering. And it's from that space of compassion that you can then bring your attention to include the one that caused injury. To sense what pain in them might have caused them to act in ways that were hurtful. Just to see the bigger picture. Their confusion, their hurt, their fear, their needs. Not to excuse, but to understand. Holding this bigger truth of the person's vulnerability in your awareness, the traditional phrase of forgiveness, and you might mentally whisper the person's name. I see and feel the pain that you've caused me, and I forgive you now. Or if not yet ready to forgive, it's my intention to forgive you. If not yet ready to forgive, it's my intention to forgive you. And as a way to end the meditation, just to feel the direct experience of being here with a forgiving heart, a heart that intends to forgive. Being here in a space of compassionate presence. A compassion that holds the vulnerability within our own beings and within each other and all beings. So that whatever arises right now in these final moments can be touched with the heart of compassion. Forgiven, forgiven, held with love. These are the words of Rumi. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other doesn't make any sense. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. Namaste.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.